Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the last week of January 2018. I'm your host, Paul Rubin. Today, I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Shelley Solomon. Shelley is an environmental filmmaker, biologist, landscape architect, and water quality restoration specialist. Thanks for joining us, Shelley.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Can you tell us more about your background in the environmental field and environmental filmmaking?
Sure. Well, I've had a variety of backgrounds, but they've all been focused on environmental issues. And I've pulled sort of the background from all my previous backgrounds as a biologist and a landscape architect and also dealing with water quality into an interest in bringing these types of stories to the big screen as a filmmaker and trying to inspire the next generation to care about the planet.
Great. And I can already tell you're a professional because we've already analyzed these microphones in the room, and I could tell you know what you're talking about when it comes to filmmaking and the equipment involved. Today, Shelley and I will be discussing the history of the Pacific oyster, the topic of her film, Ebb and Flow, which will be showing in Port Angeles on February 10th. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. This resident shorebird is distinct among its fellow beachcombers and is exclusively found along the Pacific coast of Alaska and Baja California. It's large, stout, boasts a black head and body, and has a red ring around its yellow eyes and a bright orange bill. A sharp-shinned hawk dodging between a scattered set of Douglas fir and leafless red alders gave me motivation for a brief moment of wildlife observations last week. A northern flicker swooped its way to the top of a leaning fir and after settling, made a single kier call to make other species aware of its presence. Northern flickers, like other woodpeckers, climb and hammer on trees. Unlike other woodpeckers, they forage through dirt, digging and sucking up ants. A large group of pine siskin flew tree to tree, preying on the cones of deciduous seeds, before being scolded by the territorial call of a Steller's jay. A common raven, red-tailed hawk, and bald eagle partitioned their time in the sky over an open meadow. Varied thrush mixed their way into a much more common group of spotted towhee and dark-eyed junco, kicking and scratching for their breakfast. Black-tailed deer walked lazily up a dirt road while song sparrows fluttered uncontrollably around them. Pacific wren took full advantage of a pile of freshly cut wood. They ate their way in slumbering Pacific dampwood termites in seconds. It was a great morning to be outside. We're back to our topic for the day with Shelley Solomon on the history of the Pacific oyster. Before we talk about the Pacific oyster, Shelley, can you speak briefly about the history of the Olympia oyster?
Sure. I can talk about the native oyster, and a lot of people don't know about it. It's a little tiny oyster about the size of a 50-cent piece, and the Native Americans along the West Coast would eat it. It plummeted in about 1900. The numbers collapsed because of the pulp and paper industry. The effluent from that was very toxic, and also over-harvesting. People that were harvesting or wanted to sell Olympia oysters would go into areas and just decimate entire populations. So they didn't understand the basic life cycle of oysters. And through that concept of just decimating a whole population in a bay, they basically almost wiped it out.
And just to give our listeners an idea, the Olympia oysters are much smaller than Pacific oysters, which what would you say, double the size, triple the size?
Well, it depends on where they're growing. In 3 years around here, an Olympia oyster is about the size of a 50-cent piece. In 1 year here, we're talking in Washington State, in 1 year, a Pacific oyster would be the size of a woman's small hand.
Mm-hmm. It's a big difference.
A huge difference.
Yeah.
But I was recently in Alaska. It takes much longer, actually, for the Pacific oysters to grow. It all depends on
conditions.
You know, food sources and things like that.
Well, yeah, there's a lot involved. I think definitely a big difference. So it's easy to identify the differences. Is the Pacific oyster native to the Pacific coast of North America?
No, it's not. Actually, they renamed it the Pacific oyster after the war because of the stigma of the war, because the Pacific oyster actually came from Japan. because of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, people literally would not eat the Pacific oyster.
Yeah, because it was the Japanese oyster.
Yes, at that time, yeah.
Oh, wow. What makes the Pacific oyster a unique non-native species, I guess, in terms of the conservation of Olympia oysters and the ecosystem services they provide?
Well, the Pacific oyster now, the shell of the Pacific oyster, is now being used in restoration efforts for the Olympia oyster. And they basically shoot the shell out into areas where there's remnant populations of the native oyster, and then the baby seed basically attaches to the Pacific oyster substrate. It's unheard of for a non-native species to help in the recovery of a native species.
Yeah, we're not going to get into it, but it's a very unique non-native species in that it does provide that substrate for the native species. But as far as competition, we'll get into that at another time. I'd love this subject, so maybe we'll have somebody else on. Can you give our listeners a brief explanation of the biology of oysters?
The oysters spawn, and they release egg and sperm into the water to be fertilized. And the female, she releases about 5 to 8 million eggs at one time.
Wow, that's a lot at once.
Yeah.
I'm aware that there is a rich story behind the arrival of the Pacific or Japanese oyster. Would you like to talk about that for a moment and kind of talk about your film, which
comes into there? Yeah. Well, that's a huge topic, and the reason your viewers should see our new film called Ebb and Flow. It covers over 100 years of the shellfish industry in the Pacific Northwest, what happened to the Olympia oyster, and why and how the Pacific oyster was brought to America from Japan. Anyone who has ever enjoyed fresh, locally grown Pacific oysters or values the clean waters of the Olympic Peninsula will come away from Ebb and Flow with an appreciation for, until recently, the unknown story of a hardworking immigrant family that played such a pivotal role in today's shellfish farming industry. Today, this immigrant oyster, the Pacific oyster from Japan, is considered the premier oyster by chefs across North America, and it's the largest shellfish industry in North America. So it's a pretty fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. As an environmental filmmaker, is there ever a certain message you're trying to get across with viewers in your films?
Well, the focus of our company is to tell positive stories. You know, there's a lot of films that are made, and when people talk about the environment, they tend to be sort of doom and gloom oriented. But what we have learned from being filmmakers is that you have to be open to... You can't be in a box. You have to be open to where your story will take you. We were approached to do the film on Ebb and Flow. It didn't sort of fit into the box we normally put our films in, the sense of positive stories. But as we researched it and found out that it was a rich Northwest story of what happens when you don't understand a species and there's a collapse of a species, and seriously, what happened in the early 1900s with the bringing in of a different species and what happened in the industry. So we let that story unfold through time. So being open to a story and the stories within the stories is important in any kind of filmmaking, regardless of the subject.
I think it's different when you're so involved in a film. I know that you become the film.
Yeah.
I do some videography for fun. It's actually part of the reason I'm here is because I want to do videography. The trip I got here was all a great opportunity to film, and everything is a great opportunity to film if you have a passion about any single subject. And once you kind of latch on to that, you become that subject for a brief period of time, I think, in positive and negative ways. Can you give us, for your environmental films that you're shooting, can you give us like a Tuesday? What is a Tuesday like? Or what's a regular day? Is it fun? We kind of already talked about this for a little bit. It's not easy. I want to give our listeners, it's not easy to be an environmental filmmaker.
Well, my days are very varied depending on the season. Most of the filming we do is outdoors. I do a lot of films on construction sites, environmental restoration. We're working on a film right now for the city of Seattle on a cutting-edge river restoration project where there are components of it that have never been done ever before. So being on a construction site and having gigantic excavation equipment and hot days and watching your back just in case you might get run over.
Heavy machinery.
Heavy machinery, very loud, trying to do interviews. We've done a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I got to see a sneak peek of your next film, a lot of the animation involved, but can you give a quick reason why it's so different and its kind of scope? I guess it's a lot more specific. There's more layers involved with this restoration project.
Oh, absolutely. And this film's called Engineering with Nature. There's a lot of environmental restoration happening in the Pacific Northwest, re-meandering rivers, putting wood in rivers for habitat and flow patterns. But this one also includes that, but it also includes a subsurface area called the hyporheic zone. And the hyporheic zone is a word that most people don't know about. It's a whole subsurface world. I don't even know if I can say the word avatar, but it's a microscopic world of creatures that live on rocks below the surface of the river, and this subsurface area is very important for all rivers. It's sort of the life force of rivers, and it's taken till the project was installed in 2014 for people to see the value in putting a hyporheic zone into a restoration project. That said, our film projects are very diverse in their subjects, and we keep busy with projects all the time.
And you did say earlier that Ebb and Flow was kind of a unique project because it is different than other projects that you've worked on.
In the researching of the topic, I think the most shocking thing to me, not only as an environmental filmmaker, but also as a restoration biologist, is the collapse of a species in 1900. And that was shocking to me, thinking 118 years ago, that there was enough pollution from the pulp and paper industry to collapse an entire species. So along with not understanding life cycles and over-harvesting and that sort of thing. So it's a lesson to all of us to be careful and protect the species that still exist, even though Olympia oysters still exist, but it was on the brink of collapse. Mm-hmm. They're being restored now, but it was shocking to me, seriously, that Olympia oysters were on collapse in 1900.
If you think of that time period in general, logging was a big thing and mm-hmm. damming was a big thing. A lot of just manipulation of the environment was at a forefront. That's what people were doing. They were harvesting.
But still, in 1900, the population wasn't that intense. Mm-hmm. There was lots of forests and things like that, but I would say there's a lot in the last 50 years, but we're talking 118 years ago when Seattle wasn't even very big. So to me, that spurred interest in like what happened.
Yeah. I'm glad that we still have the native species. And I think at this point, there are five different species that are brought here total, but Pacific oysters are the ones that are mostly farmed at this point.
The Pacific oyster is mostly farmed now, but there's other oysters that are very, very popular, but the Pacific oyster is really hardy and it's really popular. It grows really fast and people love it.
For the size, you get more bang for your buck, I guess. And they do have that important ecosystem service that filters the water and kind of creates habitat for other animals and food for other animals too. That will conclude our interview about the Olympia oyster and the Pacific oyster and all the films that you have coming up. So excited to talk about those. But let's hear that mystery sound one more time. Those were the loud whistling weeps of a black oyster catcher. Probing along the shoreline during low tide with their bright orange bills, they hunt for a variety of marine invertebrates. The black oyster catcher's usual prey are mussels, limpets, and whelks, but rarely oysters. Perhaps they should be more properly named black mussel catchers. The southern extent of their range overlaps with another oyster catcher, the Pacific race of American oyster catcher. Black oyster catchers begin to thin out in Baja California as the rocky seacoasts give way to sandier habitat, which the American oyster catcher prefers. Black oyster catchers are entirely black between Alaska and Oregon. However, southward from there, they begin to show an increasing number of white feathers and a browner abdomen. Thank you for the Cornell Ornithology Lab, Macaulay Library, and allaboutbirds.com for sound recordings and descriptions. For upcoming events, the Jefferson County Conservation District is currently taking orders for its annual native plant sale on March 3rd. I'm looking forward to planting Pacific dogwood, red flowering currant, and numerous native shrubs and coniferous trees. Orders must be received by February 16th, and pickup is at Jefferson County Fairgrounds between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m., or at the Quilcene Community Center at 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. on March 3rd. The Clallam County Conservation District's native plant sale is also on March 3rd at Lazy J Tree Farm between 9:30 and 12 p.m. The last day to pre-order the CCD plant sale was on January 25th. Shelley, would you like to talk about the next upcoming event?
Yes. This year, the Noxious Weed Control Board is partnering with local parks for weed removal and restoration in our public spaces. A rotation of work will take place until the end of this year. The Noxious Weed Control Board plans to measure their impact and publish results with the community. A work party on January 27th to remove noxious weeds, replant natives, and maintain trails at Irondale Beach County Park has already taken place. But you can join future events at Irondale Beach County Park on April 28th, July 28th, October 27th. Contact Coordinator Assistant Mallory Weinheimer for more information.
Year-round opportunities to assist in the Elwha Revegetation Project are available at the Mount Albright Native Plant Center. Drop-in days are Mondays and Wednesdays, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Opportunities to assist with replanting the dewatered reservoirs and other impacted sites in the Elwha River Valley are scheduled 1 to 2 times per month from October to March. Contact them by email or phone for more information.
Speaking of the Elwha, we as a film production company, Leaping Frog Films, created two films. One was an art film just prior to the removal of the dams, just a few days prior. We got a Cineflex camera, $600,000 camera, attached it to a helicopter and flew from the headwaters down to the mouth of the river. And we have that film for sale. And it's set to tribal music and tribal poetry. And it's a beautiful, beautiful film to see. And the river has changed a lot since then. So this is sort of the only archival footage pre-dam removal in existence. And then we also made a film where we were embedded with the tribe for 3 years. And they were installing the largest number of engineered log jams for salmon recovery ever attempted in size and number. And it's a really, really, really interesting story of the preparation for dam removals in the sense of preparing the actual physical river to deal with all the sediment that was going to come down. So if you're interested with that, contact us at Leaping Frog Films, and we have those for sale.
Great. Well, thank you for adding that. I know that February 10th, Ebb and Flow is going to be showing in Port Angeles. Can you tell us what theater or where, what venue, and what time it's going to be showing?
Yeah, Ebb and Flow will be showing, as you mentioned, February the 10th at 5 p.m. Peninsula College in the Little Theater in Port Angeles. And the event comes with fresh oysters from the Jamestown's Clallam Tribe, along with wine from the Port Townsend Vineyard. And you can purchase tickets through Leaping Frog Films. Better actually that you contact us prior to get your ticket so we know how many oysters to bring.
Thank you again, Shelley, for joining us. Happy to have you on today, and thank you for listening to another episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Oysters and Pearls, sung by Jimmy Buffett.
Lindbergh left Long Island in 1927, thumbed his nose at gravity and climbed into the heavens. When he returned to Earth that night, everything had changed for the pilot and the planet. Everything was rearranged. We're a pretty mixed up bunch of crazy human beings. It's written on our rocket ships and in early cable scenes. does the show. Others take a chance. Still, it's all a mystery, this place we call the world, where most live as oysters, while some become pearls. Was the only man from Northeast Mississippi who could shake his hips and still be loved by rednecks, cops, and hippies. It's something more than DNA that tells us who we are. It's method and it's magic. We are of the stars. Some never fade away. Some crash and burn. Some make the world go round. Others watch it turn. Still, it's all a mystery, this place we call the world. Most are fine as oysters, while some become pearls. Lindbergh left Long Island in 1927.